ancestors of long ago lived in a very different concept of the world from the one that we know today. Perhaps the greatest difference was in the universal recognition that reality was spiritual, not material. That all physical and material things were suspended from spiritual causes. And man, searching for these causes, instinctively turned his attention to what he regarded as the superior parts of the world. Ancient man had already come to a very important decision concerning the mystery of life. He assumed it to abide in the furthermost parts of the world and the innermost parts of himself. To him and to those who came after him, the term heaven came to have a double meaning. It was not only the spiritual abode of the blessed dead, the home of the gods, and the dwelling place of beings that never became visible to our perceptions. Heaven was also the great diffusion of space. This tremendous vaulted mystery seemed to enclose the world as man knew it. Therefore, when he referred to terms such as heaven and earth, he could have more than one meaning. Heaven could be the starry firmament and all that lay beyond it. The earth could not only be the planet upon which we live, but matter, wherever diffused or distributed through the sidereal forms of things. Thus, in antiquity, the world does not correspond either with the solar system or the cosmic system or the planet itself. The world is a state of being. And for particular purposes, the ancient regarded the world as the material state of being. He extended it outward, not only to the orbits of the planets, but out into space, into all the hypothetical physical forms that might exist anywhere in the great material diffusion of matter and substance, and of elements and essences. He then gradually came to conclude that there were three kinds of energies operating in all created things. The first was direct energy, which he associated with the sun, or with, perhaps more correctly, the great spiritual source of the solar light. The second was reflective energy, which he sensed as being turned from the surfaces of the planetary bodies, shining not with their own lights, but with the lights of the heavens. And a third kind of energy, which he called material energy, which emanated from the earth itself and was a kind of physical kind of energy. Thus he had three energies: spiritual, psychic, material. And he called the lowest or material energy force. And he considered force to be the dominant factor in the moving and molding of matter. He considered reflective energy, or that from the planets, as formal, or relating to the principle of form, and therefore that all compound natures, which are forms, are sustained by planetary energy. He then assumed that the spiritual life and power at the root of things, consciousness, essence, life per se, came from a further kind of energy which he regarded as solar, or belonging to the pure life of a sun. He then populated the firmament with suns, declaring that they were scattered like flowers throughout the great field of the sky, and that all these blazing suns together constituted the collective spiritual energy which sustained creation. These suns were what he called in those days, particularly the Chaldeans, the father fountains of all things. For these suns were like vast springs rising in the fields of eternity and watering with their life all of the structures which we call created or creation. Thus, from the beginning, he had a very spiritual concept of the universe in which he lived. All causes came from the great spiritual sources of life. He did not fully understand these sources, nor was he perhaps equipped to analyze the astronomical mystery of the cosmos. But he did live under the strong conviction that the sky that enfolded him was the source of a life which came from divine beings, and that the heavens were populated with a race of gods, and that the shining eyes of these gods watched him at all times, and they spread the mantles of their starry forms over the whole of creation. Thus religion inevitably borrowed much of its coloring from these spiritual ideals. Today we hold a somewhat contrary viewpoint. We build upward from matter. We assume our own material state to be a kind of center from which we seek to expand or spread out into space. Perhaps some do hope to find in space the answers to the mysteries of existence. But we are groping out towards spirit, whereas our ancient forebears lived forever in the acceptance of spirit. They lived forever in the realization that their little life was rounded by a vast spiritual scheme or plan. It was natural that the ancients, possessing as they did so strong and powerful an interest in philosophy, should have gradually organized the primitive opinions and convictions that had arisen in human experience. Thus, by degrees, theories were developed, concepts were formulated to explain the great mysteries of space. These explanations were not essentially very different from our own. We used more scientific terminology, and we have certain calculations to support our opinions. But ancient man did not differ so much from us in conclusions as we might immediately suppose. We assume that he must have been ignorant in comparison to what we know. But as we have said in other talks, primitive man seems to have possessed an intuitive power to grasp at realities. He lacked the words, he lacked the convenient terms and idioms with which to express what he had discovered or what he had felt or known. But at the same time, he has left us, perhaps crudely but effectively, the record of his contemplations. So astrotheology must include this understanding of space, of the worlds, of creation, and of the laws governing all of these things. Perhaps one of the most complete expositions of this that we have will be found in the religions of ancient India. Here we find astronomer Brahmins, students of space and time, working with the great foundations of knowledge even as we labor today. These ancient Brahmins not only possessed unusual intellectual powers, but a tremendous daring of spirit, which enabled them to evolve and perfect concepts that almost overwhelm us, even today. Their estimate, for example, of the length of life of a solar system was so mathematically amazing that we do not yet dare to believe it, yet we have never proved it to be untrue. All of these extensions, mathematical, scientific, rational, resulted in the gradual integration of a great concept of macrocosm-microcosm analogies. Analogies of the operations of laws on different levels, and the gradual extension or expansion of the things that we know out into the great vistas of the unknown, seeking to conquer that which is beyond our sensory perception with the pure strength of our reasoning and intuitional faculties. So we have some interesting points which they made, which come within the province of our present thinking, and so we will attempt to expound at least some phases of their beliefs on these matters. To the ancient Brahmin, to the ancient Hindu scholar, space was first of all a totality, a unity. It was not an absolute diffusion going on forever and ever. It was a totality without boundaries, as far as we can conceive boundary. It was an allness that was also a oneness. For space, to these ancient people, was the ultimate answer. It was the only recourse of the mind or of the reasoning power in attempting to analyze an existence as we know it. All lines of research, all endeavor, all contemplation, moving from the familiar outward to the unfamiliar, passes gradually into a rarefied atmosphere in which mind and contemplation seem to fail. There is somewhere out there a point or a condition in which the conceivable fades into the inconceivable, the knowable into the unknowable. That which has an existence in time retires into an eternity. And in this great collective concept of ultimates, ancient man established his definition of space. Space was ultimate. Space was unconditioned, for it preceded condition. It was ultimately again unconditioned because it extended beyond condition. All things that exist arise in space and vanish into it again. Thus space, and all that it represents symbolically, is the eternal. It is that which has neither beginning nor end. It has no upper nor lower parts. It has no superior or inferior members. It goes on forever. Every part of itself full of life. Every part of itself germinal and seminal. Every part of itself capable of releasing beings from itself. It is a completely rich, inconceivable kind of earth. An invisible earth in which everything grows. And everything has its taproots in space. For from this one eternal condition, all other conditions must come. Thus this unconditioned cannot be vacuum, cannot even be continuum as we know it. It must be total fullness. Space must be the most complete of all things. There can be no lack anywhere within it, no strange bubbles in which itself it is empty. It cannot contain or consist in vacuum. It is total fullness, total allness. And it is therefore also and continuously the source of every conditioned existence. Thus space and the great field of the sky came symbolically to be associated. Space, however, was more than sky, because we must realize that the ancient did not have a material space. He did not know of space as merely the extension of matter. To him, space was essentially a spiritual fullness. But in his scientific thinking, he was not content merely to use a platitudinous definition of spirit. To him, spirit was not a theological thing. Spirit was actually a condition, an endless, eternal fullness of all things. Spirit was life, total life. Life capable of producing an infinite diversity of lives, but of itself, one. Space was an absolute nutrition. Space nourished everything. All things, directly or indirectly, are fed from space. Because everything that supports life is in turn supported by space. The space is the ever-providing. Space is the ever-benevolent parent. The space spreads itself and diffuses itself so that it is everywhere. There is space between every dancing atom. There is space between all cells. There are spaces between planets. But these spaces are not emptiness. They're bridges of fullness, binding things together. Space also contains within itself the roots of the binding and loosing. It does act as an eternal agent of binding. Nothing can escape from it. And in some way, beneath its invisible and apparently completely flexible azonic constitution, there is something that is fixed. something that is firm beyond all firmness, strong beyond all strength, and enduring beyond all endurance. The space carries within it foundation, place, and in its own mysterious way, moving upon itself, it engenders time. For time is an unfolding, a moving of duration in space. And on and on and on these calculations, these reflections, these meditations go. Until ultimately, the ancient world regarded space as the final God, the absolute deity. Absolute because no one could find any way of discovering the finite within it. It maintained all finite things. They were parts of it, but it was totality, and the only totality. And everything that exists, when mingled with everything else that exists, exists. These sums together can only equal space. So space is not only the place in which all things are, it is the substance from which all things come. And within it move the laws and principles by which all things are guided and directed. And in space we have great foundations, not only of energy, of time, and of duration, of extension and dimension. We have within it also the great orders of organization. Space is totally archetypal. It contains within itself an infinite diversity of patterns. For it contains every conceivable form, every conceivable structure, every conceivable radiation or pattern or design that can exist anywhere. All the different forms of flower and fauna, all these are forms which have their roots in space. Therefore, space is formal also, for it contains the right of all things to have form, and it bestows form according to law. Somewhere also among these infinite diffusions of space lurk the principles of universal law and order. Here were the great patterns, not only of form and of structure, but of moral, of ethics, of all cultures and arts, all of the discoveries that man can ever make on any level or any plane must first exist somewhere in the infinite fullness of space. It was quite conceivable, therefore, that this term space had far more meaning than we give to it today. It became a symbol of the totality of life, the total and complete sufficiency of this source from which all things gain not only their right to exist, but the very elements and essences of their existence. Now, this space was populated with a concatenation or order of powers. And this order of powers extended beyond any dimension that we can conceive. For just as surely as there is an infinite number of living things upon this earth, so there is an infinite number multiplied by itself of things existing in space. And in space we find the race of the giants, the race of the great divine heroes, the gods who are over worlds and over creations. And the ancient, struggling with his concepts, seeking to determine the way in which all these things operated, came upon a mysterious pattern of septenaries. Everything evolved or developed in terms of sevens. And therefore, in the very dawn of things, a septenary of powers, representing the seven primary attributes that man was able to experience concerning universal energy. These attributes, as emanations or as emergences, flowed out of space. They were the primary archetypal form generated within space. Now, by what means and under what conditions are we to assume that space, moving endlessly in its own nature and substance, should pass through alternations of objectivity and subjectivity? The ancient, observing everything else in space, assumed likewise that motion was there. Motion originated in a movement of space. Motion existed in two forms, or of two kinds, motion in suspension and motion in action. Space in its own substance was infinite motion in suspension. space contained the potential of all movements because it possessed all direction. But this movement passed through alternate periods of action and inaction, an immense rhythm residing within space, like a cosmic pulsation, just as the tides of the earth ebb and flow. So the tides of space are forever moving, and space is either outpouring or indrawing constantly. Space is like a breathing, the breath of Shiva. It breathes forth worlds by exhalation, and it draws them back into itself again by inhalation. Thus everything in space is either moving from the spatial energy or returning to it again, forming great arcs and resulting in a curved continuum which ultimately ends in an infinite circle. These things, therefore, these beliefs, caused the ancients to assume that at certain times and under periodic conditions, space became objective. Space moved from its own pureness into the extension of itself, remained there for a time, and then flowed back again in what the ancient Indians called the days and nights of Brahma. And in the night of Brahma, the universe, space, cosmos slept. And in the day of Brahma, it came forth again into manifestation. And when it first came into manifestation, it burst forth as a radiant or glorious energy. And this glorious energy was immediately broken by space itself upon the spectrum of itself to form the great basic spectrum of seven colors, seven powers, seven gods, seven lights. So according to the ancients, when space becomes creative, there comes forth from it seven foundations, seven immense principles of principles, dependent upon principles. Seven magnificent energies of energies, dependent upon energy. These energies are conditions of energy. And the coming forth of the seven does not mean that space is seven times manifested. Rather, that each of these manifestations is one seventh of the potential of space. So that when they blaze forth together to their own total fullness, they reveal space. And these seven became seven great suns. And these seven suns are totally invisible to the sight of man. They are seven great centers of cosmic life. And they are so vast and so inconceivable that their bodies, the bodies of these seven together, constitute all known and unknown space. They form a strange overlapping of circles and of planes or levels. But these seven together extend beyond anything conceivable to man, for they have no actual boundaries except the boundaries of eternal space itself. These seven great suns in turn gave birth out of themselves to seven, each one to seven more suns. And these in turn burst forth and broke apart radiated as seven more, until this division took place six times, and the universe was filled with these blazing suns. And then came the seventh, and with the bursting of this seventh came forth that race which we call in astronomy universal suns. In other words, we haven't even gotten down yet to the point where astronomy can conceive or take over the procedure. Because we are now dealing with the gradual filling of the parts of space set aside for creation with this tremendous race of solar beings. And at the extremity of the great process, as we know it, came forth the cosmic suns. And these cosmic suns each had its throne in the great diffusion of space. And each of these sovereign cosmic suns existed within the body of one of the greater orders, which in turn dwelt within one still superior to itself, until finally, by retiring upward through this tremendous cycle of manifestation, man returned ultimately again to space itself. Now these universal suns, each with its own power, created its family, broke forth into its own manifestation as cosmic suns. And these cosmic suns in turn brought forth their progeny of lights, and these became the suns of solar systems. Thus our sun is one of these, said by the ancients to be 8 degrees removed from cause, and to be therefore one of the lesser lights of the sky, one of the smaller parts. And the other great orders of suns and their cosmic systems and their universal chains and their great space organizations became symbolized to the ancients as the great field of constellations. For these constellations to the ancients were all alive. Everything in space was alive. There was no death. And these orders above us were simply races superior to our own, races of solar giants, each in turn part of some order greater than itself. Until finally, out of all this mystery and diffusion came the simple mystery of our own solar world. Now these suns in space, cosmic, universal, and beyond, each had its own progenies, and each produced its own kind of planets, and these had their luminaries. And within the orders of all these great systems, creatures came into existence. Creatures whose names we know nothing about, but who were the citizens of vast orders infinitely greater than our own. Some of these orders were so great that our entire solar system would not be as large as one of the simple organisms evolving within one of the still greater ones. All of these speculations came finally down to man's concept of the solar deity. And the solar deity was therefore the direct focal point of all these other powers. And through the solar energy, all of the vast organism of chaos and cosmos were released into the consciousness or integration that formed our way, our planet, our solar system. Thus, we have a kind of concept of space that is pretty big, one that is almost too large for us to contemplate. And within all of this tremendous diffusion, everything is unfolding and evolving according to law. And this law is not something imposed from without, but something which is natural to the energies themselves by means of which this diffusion is maintained. All of these processes obey their own natures. And as each thing obeys its own nature, it becomes the law for those things less than itself or that exist within its own nature. Thus the total purpose of a thing becomes the law of its parts. A man living within the mystery of the solar field, therefore, follows the laws of the sun and follows the geometry and psychology and astronomy of the solar world itself. Man contemplating these things from his own earthly position, looking up therefore into the sky and unable to contemplate the totality of this mystery by rationality, divided space into three stratifications. That is, suitable to his own comprehension. He recognized that there were more classifications, but they were simply beyond him. But he did see in space three apperceivable things, three qualities that he could, to a degree, comprehend. And the first of these great diffusions of the firmament he called the first motion, the primum mobile, the great motion of the world. And he declared that this motion, this rhythm, this tremendous continuance of ever-flowingness represented to a great degree the life of God. That this life was a life forever in motion, both quantitative and qualitative motion, far more than anything we know. But he likened this motion to the tremendous motion of the heavens. He saw the heavens moving about the earth in a great pageantry, an eternal processional without beginning or end. Then the second division of the heavens, which he recognized, was a kind of psychic field, which was located between the first motion and the firmament. And this psychic field was the seed ground of souls, For as all spiritual things have their life in the first motion, so souls have their life in the first formative processes of space. Souls were therefore the oldest of forms, inasmuch as they were all compounds, composed of a spiritual and a material factor. The third part of this great circle of the heavens, the third concentric layer of it, the one inward and nearest to man, was called the firmament. And this firmament was a kind of wall built around space, a crystalline wall enclosing within itself the mechanism of the solar system. Therefore, beyond the planets and their orbits were these three divisions of the sky, going on and on and on. And in these divisions were the abodes of the great creator gods. Always these gods dwelt in the heavens, in the firmament, because to the ancients the heavens represented the sphere of causes, the sphere of principles and energies, the invisible from which the visible came. And this invisible was a world of itself, a thing apart, populated by beings that were real but invisible. And to these were given various names, and where they were called the gods. Now the firmament, as because it enclosed the solar system, and therefore represented the uppermost parts of our physical solar world, this sphere was like a mountain, for it was above the earth, and it was far above the range of mortal mountains. And to the Indian philosophers, this mountain was Meru, the abode of the gods. To the later Shivites, it was Kalasa, the great mountain of Himavat. It was the Olympus of the Greeks and the mysterious Jerusalem golden mountain of Christianity. It was a mountain because it was above, and men lifted up their eyes unto the hills from whence cometh their help. So man, looking upward, did so not just quantitatively or physically, but in a symbolic sense, a looking toward the superior. And this superior for him was the strange sky that closed him in as with a curtain of blue spangled with stars. In this process, therefore, we begin to see how the ancients devised their egg of the world, the strange shell of this egg being the firmament, and beyond the firmament another world extending on and on. We get a very good picture of this concept in the revelation of St. John, also in Muhammad's night journey to heaven, and in the divine Pymander of Hermes Trismegistus. Here we also find it in the descent of Istar through the seven gates of the descend into the underworld, because this heaven abode was separated from the earth upon which man stood by the royal arches of Enoch, the royal arches of the sky, the arcs of the planets. And as man ascended through the orders and orbits of these planets, he came near to the Empyrean, or the great abode of the stars, the firmament. And by inspiration, by inward illumination, this ascent lifted him above matter and into the abode of the gods. And this was represented by placing a small door in the sky, through which St. John is said to have passed in his mystical reveries to examine the world that lay above. And here he found the sea of glass, before which stood the throne of the Eternal, hymned by the 24 elders, surrounded by the angels and symbols, and in the midst of it standing the Lamb with the seals of Revelation. And in this great vision, then, we had man moving into what he regarded as the causal universe. And below this causal universe, within the mysterious walls of the firmament, was a mythological universe, a universe of means represented by planets, and finally a universe of ends represented by elements. Thus the universe consisted of a cause moving through certain methods or means, and finally flowing into receptivities or ends, called material or substantial. Thus we find also in these ancient mythological concepts, all life, as Plato points out, falls into generation through the Milky Way, and from this, descending by the ladder of the planets, comes ultimately into material embodiment. The Greeks had many legends and fables about these things, but I think from the standpoint of astral theology, we have to assume that the ancients recognized the 12 signs of the zodiac and the great northern and southern constellations, forming altogether 36 major patterns in the sky. That the ancients represented these or recognized them as the channels through which the great universal energies beyond man's conception flowed down into the mystery of his solar system and into the mystery of his own corporeal life. Thus these constellations came to have certain meanings, certain distinct and special attributes, and it was believed that as the ancient Jewish people held that there were 12 tribes of Israel, Israel being an ancient generic term simply to signify the world, humanity, and kinds of life, that there were 12 orders of life that were nourished and fed by the energy which fell through the constellations of the zodiacal band, and that these 12 were further differentiated by the northern and southern constellations until 36 forms or 36 emanational currents could be recognized. It was all heaven moving in upon man, supplying him constantly with energies. It was man's concept that when his material life was finished, he would return again to the sky from which he came. He must first, however, pass through a kind of purging in purgatory, or a place of darkness underneath the earth. He went down into the earth, but his spirit returned to the stars, and beyond the stars, into the mysterious heavenly world, which was the magnificent counterpart of the lowly earth that we know. This forms a kind of study in anatomy, the anatomy of the universe. And in the researches that we carry on relating to these subjects, we become increasingly aware that all this fitted together to give us a great religious idea. A religious concept that was to remain and be restated through practically every faith of mankind. So let us try and examine for a little while the development of the concept of the mysteries as these mysteries depended upon the constellational diffusion. We told you something last week about the precession of the equinoxes and how the great religions and faiths of the world were influenced by the sun's crossing over, or the passing over of the sun at the vernal equinox. This is part of our story, but there is very much more to it. So let us try and follow for a few minutes some of the symbolism that will help us in connection with this. We all know the labors of Hercules. We also know the partial story repeated of these labors in the story of Samson. We are aware of the story of the 12 adventures or voyages of Sinbad the Sailor. All of these have to do with the same type of cosmological symbolism. This mysterious 12 returns again in the 12 prophets, the 12 patriarchs, and the judges that judged over Israel. They come back again in the jewels of the breastplate of the high priest, the loaves of the shewbread. They come again in the circle of the 12 disciples. And in all of the different groups that we have, wherever the astronomical symbolism presses itself upon religion, we find the revival of three numbers of great importance, 12, 7, and 4. These numbers always return because they are the great astronomical numbers. If then we assume that the world moves around this great circle, which was the golden or yellow road of the sun, in the ancient Chinese philosophy, we see life proceeding in this way. We find also that in this pattern, a solar system such as ours must be part of a constellational diffusion. The ancients said that our sun is a small star in the tail of one of the fishes of Pisces. Therefore, that we belong to a being or a group of beings called blessed souls. and that we are therefore ourselves one of the 12 hierarchies, that the lords or powers of the 12 signs were referred to as hierarchs. The hierarchs, for example, of Capricorn were the archangels. The hierarchs of Aquarius were the angels. And the hierarchs of Pisces are humanity. Humanity, therefore, is a divine being, a hierarchy. And this divine being is one of the 12 orders of life, supported by the zodiac, as we find it, encircling the Empyrean. Now, you might say that this zodiac encircles many suns and is made up of an infinite number of suns. So we come to a fine point that was rather carefully worked out by the ancients. This is true. Every star that forms part of the zodiacal mystery, and even those not directly within the band of the zodiac, belong in some mysterious way to these 12 hierarchs. But they are related to the zodiac in different perspectives and in different relationships. Actually, we are in the constellation of Pisces, although we do not know it. Therefore, each of the stars within a certain constellation has a certain polarization. And another star within the constellation of Aquarius has a different polarization. And as a result of that, its relation to all the other signs is different. Consequently, actually, in this great family of planets and stars, there are no two alike. Each one is in a different relationship to all the others. And each one is passing through a great cycle of growth according to the laws governing its own constellational body. For this constellational body is a superior being within which a group of suns exist and have their being. All these divisions were charted and mapped for the ancients in order to give us some concept of the magnitude of the world in which we live. Man being of the sign of the fishes, the constellation of Pisces, becomes the dominant note in connection with him. And therefore, as this was the hierarch of the blessed souls, it indicates that within this constellation, regardless of the particular sun involved with its attendant planets, there is a certain kind of growth going on, a growth unique to this particular world, to this particular sphere of growth and development. And this growth is the kind of growth that we call evolution. The fact that man and all creatures known to man must attain by a kind of growing distinguishes the hierarchy to which they belong. Man must therefore evolve, releasing from within himself by a sequence of patterns and laws the potentials locked within himself. Man is therefore placed in a world of self-improvement, a world of becoming, a world which was not known to the angels, a world that was never experienced by the archangels, because their orders of growth are different from our own. Their way of unfolding is entirely and totally dissimilar. We have therefore this strange world in which we must earn our bread with the sweat of our brow. We belong in a merit system that is peculiar to us. We belong also to a particular type of being which has within itself this great problem of ultimate assimilation. Pisces, or the sign of the fishes, is the end or the last sign of the great zodiacal band. Therefore, it is the sign which has to do with the gathering up of all other signs and all that has gone before. It is a sign that has to do with the fruition of previous labor. It is the sign which precedes the sleep or the rest of the gods. Therefore, it is the sign of the old and the end. It is the sign of things having reached destination, having completed arcs and cycles of purpose. And in this we find man living under the strange principle of retributional law, a law peculiar to his hierarchy, and a law which he must fulfill. Man, therefore, of all creatures, is most strongly and profoundly affected by these laws of karma, of destiny. because they belong to the constellation to which he is a part. And all life growing in that constellation grows by the laws he grows by. But a different group grows under an entirely different pattern of laws. Also, man has another quality derived from this hierarchy, and that is the great compassional factor, the great priesthood. For in a strange way, the sign of the fishes is the sign of priesthood. For it also has to do with that part of the solar system from which the new cycle is to be born. Therefore, that which goes to sleep at the end of humanity becomes the beginning of a new birth in time, a new organization, because it is the end of an old, the binding up of a cycle, the completion of things, the paying of debt, the compensation for all things unfinished, and finally, out of this total completeness comes the engendering of a new order of life, a new way of life. So that in a wonderful way, this sign represents the way of spiritual rebirth into another sphere or another plane of action. The ancients had all these keywords and all these keys and codes by means of which they identified the activities and powers of the different constellational groups. And each star had its way of life, and each constellation had its laws and its governors, and the principles by which it was eternally modified or it eternally advanced in its own destiny. This brings us to another concept in ancient astronomical symbolism, namely that space is full of mind, that all of these great sovereign bodies are mental entities as well as spiritual beings. They are mental energies because the ancients were convinced that the suns were alive, that they were not merely masses of energy, but they were the bodies of blessed gods. And we find this so beautifully told to us in the Emperor Julian's oration to the sovereign sun. These suns, these great centers of life everywhere in space, were conscious, rational beings. It was only in comparatively recent times that man came into the conviction that he lived in a world in which he was conscious and other things were unconscious. Ancient man believed that he possessed a minimum of consciousness, and that these greater beings around him were far more conscious and far more luminous and far more aware than himself. Man could not understand these beings, but they could understand him. Therefore, the great central suns were centers of understanding and therefore of benevolence. And each sun was a being with a spiritual integrity, a rational power of penetration and judgment, and an active principle of generation. These powers operating together meant that these great beings were actually creatures, tremendous, inconceivable creatures, yet at the same time, like all creatures, possessing sentient powers, possessing a kind of self-knowledge and a knowledge of other things, as man possesses these faculties to a more limited degree. Thus there was a sidereal population of rational gods, of great beings, children of the great and superior one from which they all came. And these, like the elders of Revelation, bowed down in adoration before the throne, the great blazing mystery of the invisible sun, which was at the root of life. Thus everything was astronomical. Everything had to do with the setting up of formal thrones by means of which the wonders of nature could be made manifest. Now the opposite extremity of this vast pageantry was what we call Earth. And Earth was a very strange thing also, because Earth was not, as we consider it, something substantial beneath our feet. The ancients were well aware that Earth as an element was floating in the midst of a diffusion of life, that Earth was a little island upon the surface of the sea of life, that Earth and all other earthy things were conditions, not essentially places nor times, but kinds of life. And Earth was to them a privation of active principles. Earth was the negative pole of heaven. Earth was the infinite receptivity into which all things of a dynamic were forever flowing. Earth was like a vessel that captured life into itself. Man's body was of earth. Therefore, it was likewise a vessel which contained and captured within itself the life of heaven. All earthy things were therefore shadows, symbols, negative extensions of life, not absolutely deficient in life, but deprived of it in some way or part. Thus, what we like to think of as matter was merely a temporary condition in this great mystery of life itself. But the ancient also had the realization that this matter, which was the source of body, which was the source of this strange prison world in which man finds himself, that this matter as a polarization was absolutely essential to the kind of life that man has to live. Ancient man differed from modern man in another particular. Ancient man had a wonderful acceptance. Ancient man never questioned the validity or the rightness of things. He accepted that which the gods bestowed. It was his power and privilege to obey, to fulfill, not to doubt. So it never occurred to him in his older days that the earth was bad or that matter had any bearing upon materialism. He never conceived of materialism as we know it, where materialism is simply a kind of worshipping of matter, whereas ancient man worshipped light and the sun and space and the gods. But if we have become a little inclined to develop a matter fixation, it is simply because in our way of life, matter is the only thing that we can see, and only things composed of some kind of matter or containing material elements are visible to us. Pure life, pure intelligence, pure love are not visible to us, except when we clothe them in some material symbol by which they become recognizable, either through their attributes or through their propensities. But matter itself, which is body, the beginning of all bodily condition, is a receptacle which receives into itself the life and light of heaven, as into another kind of earth. And from this earth, the light bursts forth again through the seed, and all things grow upward from matter towards the life which is their common source. So we have elements. Elements not only in our earth, but elements throughout space. For space everywhere is polarized. And wherever in space there is this matter pole existing, it is part of matter. Therefore, matter has nothing to do with our solar system primarily or our earth primarily. It is a condition that exists wherever life moves out into activity, because it represents the receptivity which must receive that activity. And without polarization, life cannot manifest itself. And the moment it is polarized, it becomes life and matter. So matter is the infinite challenge, that which must ultimately be filled with life and must ultimately again return to life. Now, matter produces out of its own mysteries bodies, and bodies themselves cannot exist merely out of matter. Matter is the substance, but there must always be the sculptor. Matter is the clay for the pot, but there must always be a potter to mold the clay. So matter extends on and on through space, visible and invisible, actually, for its subtler parts still transcend our perceptions. But matter goes on and on and on. It is a tremendous material from which we can build almost anything, but it remains simply a great expanse of potential. In order that this matter shall become activated, shall have the power to produce out of itself something, or to be molded or made into something, there must arise between space and matter an intermediate power. And this intermediate power the ancient called mind. And mind was the beginning of the principle of form. For mind is the power which molding matter organizes it into forms. Therefore, wherever mind operates upon matter, there is form. And both mind and matter disappear in the form. And there is a new compound or a new substance that seems to appear. And this new substance is a species or a kind of life. For minerals, plants, animals, men, supermen, deities are compounds of mind and matter. And wherever these compounds arise, we have the emergence of tangible, growing, unfolding forms of life. The molding of matter by mind makes many wonders possible to us. So the ancients interposed between the firmament of the fixed stars, the great spiritual agency, and the elements of the earth, earth, fire, air, and water, the primordial elements which they knew. Between these two, they placed the mysterious septenarial hierarchy of mind. And they formed this mind out of the mystery of the seven planets. And this mind became, by its original power, the thinker. By its reactional power, the reflector. And therefore, by the will of mind, by the creative action of mind, things are generated and formed. But by the reflective power of mind, things are regenerated and reformed. And when mind reaches the point in its development in which it moves from generation to, we might say, regeneration, when it passes from the conquest of matter to the revelation of itself through matter, it then moves into a level which we call psychic. And the soul is the regenerating, redeeming, transmuting power which arises from the reflective attributes of mind. So the ancients had their seven planets, which formed the rational focus. These seven planets gradually developed into the seven powers of the human mind, represented and enthroned in the seven parts of the brain, even as the seven powers of the spirit are located in the septenarial division of the heart. The mind, therefore, with its seven powers, became a second kind of creator, known as the Demiurgus, or the God who creates formal things.